Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and the Strategy Director at XMO Marketing. I am absolutely confident that no one listening to this episode today is here to listen to me. You've all come to listen to Rory Sutherland. If you're thinking, I don't know who Rory Sutherland is, strap yourself in and get ready for a wild ride. Rory is one of the most entertaining guests I've ever had on the podcast. His bio will tell you he's a TED talker, link in the show notes, obviously. He's an author of the book Alchemy and a best-selling book, Alchemy. And he's the vice chairman at Ogilvy UK. But none of that really makes sense until you've heard him talk about a subject, which is really behavioral psychology. And I love this subject, and I love listening to Rory talk about it, because he says things like this.
Because value is in the mind of the customer. This is what the Austrians understood. The Austrians understood that marketing was as much a form of value creation as manufacturing was.
And also like this.
When weird succeeds, it really, really succeeds.
We're back to the realms of penicillin then, aren't we, yeah. In terms of things that nobody
not just penicillin, but the Wolves Vionetta.
He's the only person on the podcast, I think, who's ever mentioned the Bible and Das Kapital. Possibly the only person in the world who's ever mentioned those two books together in the same sentence as well. He is also probably a self-confessed heretic. Now, heresy is not much of a crime these days, although would have possibly had you burnt at the stake or drowned a few hundred years ago. But we talk about that, and Rory's views on marketing might be heresy to some people. So, interesting, eye-opening. I really hope it's only part one, because there were so many subjects that we didn't even get into touching on. So I am going to pester Rory and see if he'll come back and do a second part. I'll keep everything crossed. Let me know what you think of this episode. My details are in the show notes. Any questions, any thoughts, bang them on to me. Otherwise, listen, just put your earphones in and have a listen to Rory Sutherland talk about, well, a bit of everything, really. This one is an exciting guest for me. I'm really pleased and proud to announce that I'm joined by Rory Sutherland on the Strategy Sessions. Rory, how are you?
It's a pleasure to be here. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, I am not going to read a bio out for Rory, but if you haven't seen his TED Talk, it's in the show notes. He's been on Secret Diary of a CEO with Steve Bartlett and various other podcasts. And he's always one of the most entertaining and enjoyable guests you could ever have. So this is a great day for me. But more than that, it should be a great day for you. So let's start by sort of picking Rory's brains and talking about humans and how strange we are. That's what I think we're going to talk about today. And I wanted to start, Rory, by saying, look, you wrote a book called Alchemy. And one of my favorite stories in there is about the lionfish. So do you want to tell us about lionfish, and then we can kind of talk about people from there onwards, really?
Yeah, there are a few areas where it's particularly rich, I think, to talk about the role of psychology in behaviour and business, and in problem solving in general, by the way. I think this extends much wider than just being a business concern or indeed a government concern. And one of them is railways, which we'll probably come to later. The other one is fish. Because there are various cases where simply renaming a fish has led to something which was previously despised becoming perfectly fashionable, indeed highly desired. Okay, so if you want proof of the kind of arbitrariness of humans' value systems, back in Wales, where I come from, which was rich with salmon in the Wye, and in particular in parts of Scotland, in the 19th century, quite often people would get a job as a servant in a country house, and one of their demands or conditions of employment was that they not be served salmon more than three times a week. Now, we think of salmon as a premium food. In fact, if you were in a Scottish country house in the sort of middle of the 19th century, it was kind of junk food. Lobster was junk food, by the way, in many areas of the world. You know, it was what you fed the poor. Oysters were more or less what, maintained a protein supply to the New York working classes for a time. Right. And there are more modern examples. So, for example, someone absolutely brilliant in Cornwall discovered that the pilchard, which was a kind of despised fish, probably not helped by being known as a flavour of cat food. Someone discovered that the pilchard was actually a member of the sardine family and started calling pilchards Cornish sardines. which transformed exactly the same thing from being a kind of unwanted, unfashionable foodstuff to flying off the shelves at Tesco. Mm-hmm. Cornish is probably a pretty good adjective to add to more or less anything, actually, whether it's, you know, Cornish Cruncher is, I think, one of Marks and Spencer's most successful cheeses. A similar case was the Patagonian toothfish, which most of you have probably eaten in a fancy restaurant, if you go to fancy restaurants, but you haven't been sold Patagonian toothfish. It's actually sold as Chilean sea bass. Because no one wants to eat Patagonian toothfish. A more brilliant case, I think, of a real kind of rebranding with of a fish-related problem was the lionfish, which I'm fairly sure is a Pacific fish, escaped somehow, possibly from an aquarium accident, and escaped into the Caribbean, where it was a catastrophe because it's an extremely vicious predator and it has no natural predators of its own. Probably because it's brightly colored and the fish in the Caribbean, although it's perfectly edible and tasty, fish in the Caribbean, predator fish, have evolved a distinct distaste for anything brightly colored because bright colors are often aposematic signaling in the animal world. They're a way of signaling I don't need to camouflage myself, which means I'm probably poisonous or dangerous in some other way. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why ladybirds aren't green. Okay. Ladybirds aren't green. They you know, the worst color you could be on a leaf, you would have thought, as being red. Ladybirds are actually not exactly poisonous, but they exude a disgusting taste from their knees, so that birds really hate eating them. And if you're either poisonous or disgusting in some way, ironically, it pays not to camouflage yourself, which is imitating the behavior of a tasty food. It pays to do the absolute opposite and just say, come and take me on if you think you're hard enough. Effectively, which is called aposematic signaling. It's quite often, it's quite often fake. So some other animals have learned to fake this, mm-hmm. that you adopt the appearance of a nasty snake or a nasty animal simply because you can then exploit this evolved predisposition to avoid anything that's too brightly colored. Okay. I suspect that's present in humans as well. You know, humans have very distinct color preferences with mm-hmm. food, and certain colors which are just inherently kind of disgusting. And anyway, so what happened? This thing escaped into the Caribbean, and so what Ogilvy did in Colombia, I think. I hope I've got that right. Mm-hmm. But was to effectively make lionfish a really, really fashionable fish for humans to eat. So, in the absence of a natural predator, why not go to the apex super predator, which is humans? And they got kind of Michelin-starred and awarded chefs to produce lionfish recipes, which would then encourage the fishing of lionfish. I think they got the Catholic Church to recommend it. And so what they effectively did was take something that nobody wanted to kill and turn it into something that humans wanted to eat. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of multi-pronged attack on the lionfish, but it seems to have significantly succeeded. So what you effectively did is you said, fishermen aren't going to actually bother with this thing if it has no value. So we'll give you a value. Now, I've never tasted it. I've never been to Colombia. It's apparently delicious. And so this is really, really important because actually how things taste is not, and our what you might call our predisposition to eat things is not based solely on what they are, mm-hmm. okay? It's based on the stories we tell about them and how we think of them and how we perceive them. I mean, two examples I give in the food space. One of them is miso soup, okay? Now, miso soup, I think, benefits enormously from being known as Japanese. I mean, if one of your kids or your nephews or nieces or your brother or your sister said, I've just invented this new soup. Imagine a world where miso soup didn't exist, okay? And there was this slightly murky coloured liquid with a couple of white cubes and a weird leaf in it. What you would not say to them is, hey, give up the day job. Your future's as a soup inventor. Now, I kind of like miso soup, okay, but I don't think I like it objectively. You could argue, okay, that there's quite a bit of sort of food racism, if you want to call it that. Not necessarily negative, but positive. So in a world where sushi didn't exist, if you imagine I came to you and said, there's an awful state in Somalia where, you know, the population is so poor, they're reduced to eating raw fish wrapped up in rice with a bit of leaf around it. Okay. Your reaction would not be, what a supreme delicacy. It would be, poor bastards, I hope that never happens to me. Right. And one of the most wonderful things, I never remember his name because it's bloody difficult to pronounce, but he's the same man who said, and I'm going to Google it now, the map is not the territory. And he used to indicate this. There we are. It's Alfred, I think it's Korzybski.
Okay.
And he's famous for saying the map is not the territory, but he also is less famous, but deservedly famous, for an experiment he used to do on his students in the lecture hall, which is he'd walk onto the lecture theatre stage with a brown paper bag, effectively, and start munching biscuits from the bag while he was lecturing. And then, as a sort of gesture of kindness, he'd go and hand out some of these biscuits to the front row of the lecture theatre, who'd also start chewing and munching on them, crunching away perfectly happily. And then he'd remove the brown paper bag and reveal that what it actually said was dog biscuits on the bag. Now, at that point, the reaction of the people happily crunching the biscuits completely changed from mild contentment to absolute disgust. One person was apparently sick. Okay, that's quite an extreme. I think I can manage to. Quite a lot of people spat them out into their hands or into handkerchiefs or whatever, or basically, you know, refused to eat it or consume any more of what they were contentedly eating only a short time before. And it's really, really interesting because what Korzybski said there is, he said, so you see, we don't only eat food, we also eat words. And his point was, I think, a very valid one, that the value of anything depends not necessarily on purely the objective qualities of the thing itself. Actually, when I was a kid, I used to eat Go Cat because it was quite tasty. Okay. Now, okay. I was quite young. Okay.
For avoidance of doubt, how young are we talking? 16, 17?
No, younger than that. Yeah, they're more like sort of 7 or 8. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But actually, our perception of anything, our evaluation of anything, our desire for anything is heavily contextually conditioned. And it's a nonsense, therefore, to formulate any kind of school of economics which sees value creation purely as a product of efficient manufacturing of a predefined good, mm-hmm. without understanding that a very large part of economic value is created in the mind, not in the factory. Now, unfortunately, marketers, who should have been the beneficiary of this realization, and indeed the Austrian School of Economics fully realized this. The Austrian School of Economics, which was much more attuned to psychology and what you might call behavioral considerations rather than just kind of weird considerations of efficiency, understood that marketing is as much a source of value creation as manufacturing. Unfortunately, we have a business world dominated by kind of left hemisphere thinkers who effectively believe that the definition of value is pre-existing and can somehow be mathematically determined, okay? And your job, therefore, is to create it through more and more efficient manufacturing, and that the only innovations that matter are innovations in what you can offer and how you can make it, rather than, I would argue, the cheaper, more effective, more potent, faster, and actually more interesting, though admittedly less easily defined, practice of adding value in changing how people think rather than in changing what you make. I mean, the phrase I always use is that innovation, okay, innovation and marketing are fundamentally two sides of the same coin. Okay, there are two ways you can create new economic value. You can either find out what people want and work out a really clever way to make it, or you can work out what you can make and find out a really clever way to make people want it. Okay. Now, the money you make is indistinguishable either way, but there's a strange mentality among people, particularly sort of with an engineering background or with a finance or economics background, or in B2B, actually, which is a
boring to boring, as regular listeners will know that.
But actually, B2B marketing is spectacularly important. The problem is because of this myth that all B2B decisions are completely rational. Okay. A lot of people utterly fail to realize the component of value in B2B that is actually emotionally driven. Now, so the money you make is indistinguishable whether you solve a problem or create a new value space through doing something new or making people think in a new way. I'll give you a lovely example of this, which I only discovered watching one of endless YouTube videos. It was probably on cold fusion or something like that. YouTube, by the way, I think is absolutely miraculously valuable, and that it's a perfect case of a technology really reaching its apotheosis when it's 10 or 15 years old and therefore not getting the attention it deserves. YouTube is becoming basically Wikipedia with video. One of the things I'll recommend to all your listeners is get YouTube Premium. It's 15 quid a month, ad-free YouTube. Watch it on your 4K flat screen TV. If you've got a smart TV, if you haven't, get something like Google Chromecast, okay, so that you can. Because that will now, if you're a curious person, and by dint of the fact that you're listening to a podcast, I think you're one of the kind of 30% of the population who are inherently curious. If you're a curious person, YouTube is the gift that keeps on giving. So I discovered this thing on YouTube, which is very interesting because it kind of lets... I'm always interested in decisions that had bad consequences that are then written off as bad decisions. Because accepting that a large amount of the future is unknowable, okay, you can't always say that a decision that had bad consequences was a terrible decision, nor can you necessarily say that a decision that had good consequences was a good decision. So I was at Abbey Road yesterday recording a podcast, and I made the point that actually Decca's decision to turn down the Beatles at the time was not particularly ridiculous, in that if you look at the tracks the Beatles presented to Decca on some demo tape or whatever, they're so obscure that not even weird Beatles fanatics are even aware of them. Most of them are covers, okay? And let's be honest, Love Me Do, which is their first charting song, isn't a very good song. Okay, no one could have predicted the extraordinary kind of leap between Love Me Do and I Want to Hold Your Hand, put it that way. Okay, one of them's a forgettable piece of, okay, the harmonica was a bit interesting, but apart from that, there's not much to it really. And actually what they did, Decca signed Jerry and the Tremolos instead of the Beatles, partly because they were based in London and therefore their transport costs would be lower. That wasn't a great piece of cost saving. Okay, whoever the procurement guy was involved in that, I don't think you should be selecting bands on proximity to London, right? But the second reason, they signed Jerry and the Tremolos, and actually, I'm fairly sure that the Tremolos had a number one before the Beatles did. So given what you could tell at the time, that wasn't necessarily a good decision, because no one could have expected this extraordinary kind of, apotheosis that came after Love Me Do. Even Brian Epstein thought they were a bit shit. He just saw potential where other people didn't. This is in the early days.
Yeah. And I think sometimes as well, as you say, not knowing the future there's no way of saying if the Beatles would have signed for Decca.
They wouldn't have had George Martin. And George Martin's background was in recording comedy records with the Goons, which meant he did things with them, starting with the Marseillaise, for example, which would be second nature to someone who'd worked with the Goons, but at the time would have seemed really, really weird to someone who had a conventional music background. It's rather like Nassim Taleb's point that actually all the really, really successful Eternal books – you know, whether it's the Bible or Das Kapital or whatever, violate all the principles that publishers hold dear. You know, so anyway, to get back to my YouTube epiphany, okay, I'm watching this kind of history of Netflix, and there's the famous moment where Netflix offer themselves to sale to Blockbuster Video, mm-hmm. the late Blockbuster Video, and the
RIP,
and their request for $50 million is viewed as practically an insult. You know, it's just you're being ridiculous here, okay. And everybody goes, ha, 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 the people at Blockbuster Video, they couldn't see the future, they're complete morons, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to give them a break here. And the reason is that Blockbuster Video could have replicated Netflix's technology for less than $50 million. They could have done it overnight and they could have signed up their own customers. What made Netflix valuable? And there were lots of also other players in that space. You may remember Love Film, for example, etc. Mm-hmm. What made Netflix remarkable was none of that stuff. It was an idea they had after they had failed to sell themselves to Blockbuster Video. And it was the idea of three DVDs at any time, replace them as frequently as you like, $15.99 a month, I can't remember the exact price, and no late fees ever. And they came up with that later, almost in desperation. And it so happened that that particular pricing format just captured the imagination in a way that none of their previous attempts had done so. Previously, it was kind of like, hey, it's like your local video store, but you do it by post. Suddenly, this idea that potentially, you know, now what the reason it worked is that, I mean, potentially lots of people could have been watching 25 goddamn films a month, and they would have lost a fortune. And probably actually for the first month or two, that's exactly what people did, which probably created total despair in their finance director. But rather like gym membership, most people through natural inertia settled down to a slower rate of replacement, and the whole thing finally worked. And so it was that very brave step, because you had, after all, created a business model that was potentially a living disaster if the only people who'd taken it up were utter film fanatics who were students or unemployed and watched 47 films a day. Okay, you would have been absolutely on a road to bankruptcy. But desperation forced them to try it, and it turned out that it worked. So it's unfair, because the real innovation in Netflix was not DVDs through the post. It was a pricing mechanism, which is a marketing question. Okay. And, you know, I'll say the same about solar panels, which I say repeatedly. Okay. Loads and loads of absolutely brilliant people, vastly cleverer than me, have somehow converted solar panels to a level of efficiency where they kind of make sense in the UK. You know, when I was a kid, solar energy was discussed as something you did in the Sahara Desert or Arizona, but it was never going to be anything of much use in Britain. Okay. Mm-hmm. Through utter scientific genius, you know, they've reached, you know, they're getting to a level of kind of extraordinary efficiency and double digit efficiency in terms of the conversion. Yeah. But what they failed to do is that second thing, the Netflix stage, where they've worked out how to sell them. And they have this mistaken thing, which is basically the assumption that most people have about solar panels is that I have to call in some weird company I've never heard of, okay, a totally unknown brand, who are going to cover my entire roof with solar panels. I then hope that my electricity provider will credit me for energy I feed into the grid, but I have no particular certainty around this. And then at the end of this installation, on the roof of a house which I may be planning to sell in the next 5 years, I have to write a check for 25 grand. Okay, now marketers will tell you, you know, that is an appalling way to sell things. Nobody wants to write a huge check up front for a long-term payoff that may be totally catastrophic, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what the answer is. Maybe it's mobile panels that you can take with you when you move. You know, after all, anybody with a big garden could easily just, you know, rig something up in the, you know, in the paddock, okay, right? Okay, and you know, maybe it starts off with a completely scalable thing where you buy three panels and they trickle charge your car. And so for the next 48 hours, I'm not going anywhere. I could be charging my car right now, but I'm not. Okay. And maybe you start off small, you start modular, and then after people are pretty happy with their 2 grand's worth of solar panels, they buy another 2 grand's worth. Now, apparently there's a Dutch company that's just started doing this in the Netherlands, and it seems absolutely the right way to sell this product. Okay.
Yeah.
And so this thing that engineers and finance people instinctively hate marketing, and they think that success through marketing is essentially cheating, is a massive, massive obstacle to successful innovation.
So your book is called Alchemy. And I wonder, from reading it and from listening to your talk, if you should have called it heresy. Because there's a little bit of me that's,
conventional economic theory
and what you do is you are a heretic to some of the conventional business wisdom.
Yes, it's very strange.
Do you get that pushback from clients?
Yeah. What it is that actually alchemy is heresy in a sense, because
if you have
the mentality that, you know, essentially a Newtonian mentality that something cannot be created out of nothing, okay, then magic is anathema to you, because it violates your worldview of trade-offs, proportionality, linearity, and everything else, which are the assumptions you use to make sense of the world. And it's, you know, as a result, I mean, a much cleverer person than me, the Australian economist Nick Gruen, makes a parallel point to mine, which is that the economic obsession with trade-offs and the belief that trade-offs are inevitable is actually a massive limiter on the imagination. Okay, because there are many cases, and Gruen points to several of them, where a really good idea isn't a trade-off between two opposing forces, it's a resolution of the two things to create something better. You can say, well, there's always going to be a trade-off between price and quality. Okay. And then he points to the case where Toyota managed to produce a car with the highest quality levels in the world, I think second only to a Mercedes at the time. The Mercedes had something like 37 fault checkers involved in the process, and Toyota had none. And that's because they'd invented a way where quality control was built into the manufacturing process. It wasn't a separate step. Okay, now there are lots and lots of cases where you say, oh God, the trouble with doing this is it's going to be expensive. Okay. And the marketer would say that isn't necessarily a trade-off, because you can create circumstances where people want to spend more. You know, there are lots and lots of cases in markets where people want to spend more. If you look at wine, for example, and again here, I defer to Joe Fattorini, who you may know from Channel 5 as their wine expert. He's an absolute wine expert, but he's also extremely knowledgeable about behavioral science.
Okay.
What drives consumption of expensive wine is not, okay, the fact that people want a better wine. People spend more to mark an occasion. That's probably true of women's clothes when they go to a wedding, okay? You could actually get away with, you know, Zara, ASOS, whatever, okay? But if it's your best friend's wedding, you kind of feel, I probably should drop 300 here, you know, to mark the occasion, okay? Now, a marketing guy took over Chapel Down in the UK. Now, Chapel Down produces English or British, technically, because they're also Welsh producers, British sparkling wine. British sparkling wine is actually, at its best, unbelievably good, okay? And he did improve the quality. I'm not suggesting he was entire. As I said, when I said there are two directions of travel, you know, you either make people want something or you make something they want. Most successful innovation involves a bit of both. I'm not suggesting it's one or the other. They're not mutually exclusive. Okay, the pet rock, okay, is entirely psychological value creation, okay? That's the most extreme marketing case, right? Okay. And there are other things, commodities, which are all about, you know, what the thing is. Okay, things that are bought as commodities.
Yeah.
But most things involve a bit of both. And he did raise the quality of Chapel Down, and it's, I would argue, other than perhaps the very best champagne, it's as good a white sparkling wine as you can drink. Okay. But he also did something else. He actually ramped up the price to kind of champagne prices or champagne prices plus. And what he realized is that the role of champagne is partly to drink, but it's also to communicate generosity or hospitality. You know, congratulations on your so-and-so, Andy. Here's a bottle of English sparkling wine. It doesn't matter how good that wine is. If you suspect I've paid $8.95 for it, I'm not doing the job. It's not doing the job it's supposed to do. Right.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about champagne is it's impossible to produce champagne below a certain price point. So if I give someone a bottle of champagne, they know I'm not dicking around. You know, they know I'm not skimping. OK. Yeah. And so one of the most brilliant things he did is he put the price up. And actually, the entire category, not only Chapel Down, but, you know, many, I won't call them imitators, that's unfair, but many other English sparkling wines, Welsh sparkling wines, have actually done the same thing. And it's absolutely critical because it's the classic case where actually in economics, there always has to be a trade-off. In psychology, there doesn't.
So the road to premium, sorry to interrupt you there, because there's an interesting case of Volvo at the moment, who are one of the few examples in the car category, at least, who have gone, who are moving up market. They went from kind of middle of the road family vehicle to now being, they're a premium vehicle. And putting your price up is only one step of that. But it is a difficult thing to do. A marketer would look and go, "Oh, going upstream and becoming more premium is really difficult." What? So is it just putting the price up, or is it the other things that
actually
come with it as well?
If you look at the behavior of Procter & Gamble, who are kind of the smartest tools in the box, right? The sharpest tools in the box. A huge amount of their revenue growth has come from premiumizing things. I mean, Oil of Olay, which you probably may remember from your childhood as something that was bought for like £2.75, is now, I think, over a tenner or something like
what?
That. I'll have to double check. Let me get checked. I don't want to be guilty of, here we are, Oil of Olay. Now, I think they may have improved the formulation. I'm not suggesting that it's all one thing or the other. Yeah, here we are. Olay Regenerative 24 Night Moisturizer with Retinol, 19 quid. That's in a Cardo. Regenerist 3 Point Firming Anti-Aging Cream Moisturizer, 50 milliliters at Boots, 17 quid.
I used to have this stuff slapped all over me as a child, and it must have been cheap.
By the way, the 17 quid at Boots, just a client of ours, so I'll do the, that's actually half price. Now, there are a huge number of advantages, by the way, to being expensive, to having a premium positioning, not least which is you can discount and still make money, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, I mean, one of the ways I occasionally, buy clothes is you actually go to a really expensive place like Selfridges and you go and basically search for the most discounted items. You know, now I'm not probably an advertisement for men's fashion.
Are you from Yorkshire? Because that sounds like the way I buy clothes.
But there is, I mean, okay, if you think about it, there's an extraordinary, you know, and if you can't sell something at, I'm probably doing them a disservice because actually they make quite a lot of effort in terms of sustainability. But if you can't sell something at Primark, there's nowhere else you can sell it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you look at the premium stuff, well, you've got, you know, you can have a sale and you can still make money from your sale. Okay. You've got TK Maxx, which is, as a Yorkshireman, you're probably a bit of a devotee, I'm guessing.
I am. I've got the TK Maxx tattoo just down here.
Absolutely. Just exactly. Yeah. Right. Okay. And actually, you know, the point is that value is highly contextual. I mean, if someone buys a can of refrigerated Coke from a vending machine, okay, we think of Coke as a commodity, but that refrigerated Coke is probably selling for six times as much per unit volume as the 2 liter bottle you buy in Poundland. I'm not sure they deal with Poundland, but the 2 liter bottle you buy in Aldi, okay, right? You're paying, now it is refrigerated, there's a cost of refrigeration, you know, et cetera. But nonetheless, you know, what something is worth is contextually determined. So I'm going to give this idea away for free because I'm tired of trying to sell it. This, by the way, is actually a huge problem, which is that it's very difficult to sell creative ideas, which I think limits. Okay, it's very easy to get in consultants who'll improve your productivity efficiency, okay? because a load of McKinseyites can kind of crawl around your place charging sort of 200 quid an hour for ages, right? It's really easy to make money doing that kind of bullshit, right? Whereas the problem with an idea is once you've told someone the idea, you've effectively given it away, right? Okay. And payment by the hour is almost a perfect mechanism to prevent and discourage the generation of ideas, okay? Right. You know, what that does is it incentivizes an obsession with processes and, you know, and Gantt charts and flaming bloody great 200-page PowerPoint decks. Now, my idea here, which I can't charge for, so solid I'll give it away, is why shouldn't you have Coke vending machines also be electronic car chargers? Now, there's an advantage to this, which is if I went to Sevenoaks Council and said, I'd like to put Coke vending machines on your pavements, they basically show me the door, right? But if I went to Sevenoaks Council and said, how would you like to meet all your government sustainability targets for the provision of charging machines for free, right? And the solution is we provide electric car chargers which actually sell Coke or Costa Coffee, right? Which Coke owns.
Okay, yep.
I think. Okay, yes, right. They do. Yeah. They do. Okay, right. Well, the Sevenoaks guys have got to at least think about this bad boy, haven't they, right? Now, my point is that conceptually, a Coke vending machine contains a contactless credit card thing. And by the way, outdoor contactless credit card things are quite difficult because you've got to be very cautious about the potential for fraud. It's much more difficult than an in-store one.
Right.
Okay. So you have the contactless payment mechanism, which can also cope with RFID, presumably. You have an electricity supply and you have an internet connection. Well, that, okay, plus a 7 or 50 kilowatt charging cable is a car charger.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, look, the argument here is that, looking for different contexts and places where you can sell and sell particularly profitably, an awful lot of luxury retail, okay, exists really through what you might call curation and clever merchandising, in that when you go into a shop in Bond Street, after a while, you think that a £90 t-shirt is a perfectly reasonable t-shirt because of what you've been looking at for the previous 25 minutes. Okay. Whereas on the high street in Rochdale, people would be scandalized and you'd probably have a fight.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, people's readiness to pay for things is massively contextually dependent. Okay. And so it makes obvious sense to explore this because value is in the mind of the customer. This is what the Austrians understood. The Austrians understood that marketing was as much a form of value creation as manufacturing was. And modern day economics, because it's dominated by kind of left brain reductionist thinkers, is really, well, the reason it's reluctant to acknowledge this is that once you acknowledge psychology, your maths goes out of the window. Okay. And because actually your career is probably formed in economics by constructing elegant mathematical models that bear very little relation to reality. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the last thing they want.
So a lot of what you're talking about is known as nudging. I actually think the way you're describing it, I think framing or reframing is maybe a better phrase for it. But nudging sort of shot to prominence through Cass Sunstein and the work they did in the US. And then in the UK, the book is over there somewhere with Inside the Nudge Unit by Dr. David Halpin, I think his name is.
Yeah, great. We were both at the same college at the same time, actually, would you believe it? Yeah,
brilliant. Brilliant. Well, but when I hear you,
he was actually the hardworking, diligent, and serious academic, and I was the dilettante, boozy person. I'm a very big admirer of what he's done. Actually, seriously,
I wonder when I look at the work that they've done within the government. Now, obviously, that is a place run by economists generally and politicians looking for re-election. But are they framing? Are they looking at their nudges on too much of an economic benefit? Because what you're saying is that actually you can't measure everything with a pound sign at the end of it.
This is, okay, this basically comes from the heuristics and biases school. And one of the areas in which nudging is misused okay, is people's real behavior clearly deviates here from what conventional economics would predict. Therefore, the economics is right and the people are wrong, and our job is to nudge them into behaving more like Homo economicus and less like Homo sapiens. Now, I'll give you an example of this, which is I went to a government thing on how do you get younger people to invest in pensions, because obviously the payback is significantly higher the earlier you invest. Okay, now this is worth doing. I'm not for a second saying it's not worth doing. And one of the things I said is the first thing you need to do is redesign the pension so that people can draw it down before they reach 55. Because when you're 25, being 60 is basically, I mean, that's another planet, right? Mm-hmm. It's rather like why it's difficult to stop young people smoking, because, you know, the diseases of the relatively elderly are, you know, being elderly is such a remote, you know, they've only had, you know, 6% of their adult life to date. And so they can't, I mean, I remember this, I was a copywriter on pension stuff when I was in my 20s, and I couldn't really understand why anybody put money away rather than going out for a curry. You know, I mean, I was forcing myself as a sort of method actor into that mindset. I couldn't really get my head around it, to be honest, you know. So the first thing you have to do is, you know, you have to redesign and rethink the pension. Maybe you don't even call it a pension, right? You call it young person saving fund, whatever it may be, and it can morph into a pension later in life. So, you know, maybe the word pension associated with words like pensioner is problematic to begin with. But the fact that you wave goodbye to this money until you're actually quite old is ridiculous, because you don't know what the near future, what middle age is going to bring. Okay, you know so little about your future. But there's also a factor. I said, look, I'm really, really happy in lots of ways to help you do this, because I think there are biases against young people saving. Okay, but I said, at some point, do not expect people to behave as economically rational actors would do, for the simple reason, I said, you know, look, basically Darwin, right? Okay, when you're 25, there are a load of things, okay, which are probably more important to you and to your long-term happiness than saving up for a distant future, one of which might be finding a high-quality life partner. Okay, now, without stereotyping anybody, there are lots of quite extravagant things you may have to do to find a high-quality life partner, i.e. not being stingy, not going Dutch when you go out for the first meal, okay? And I'm fairly confident in saying that among people, I don't go there, I'm married, okay? And, you know, I feel, by the way, as someone who actually got married before there was Tinder, I feel like someone who just caught the last helicopter out of Saigon, basically. I wouldn't know how to date nowadays. I wouldn't have a clue. But I'm fairly confident you don't get many people under 30 or under 40 on Tinder boasting about how great their pension is, right? Mm-hmm. It's just not a major pull, right? In fact, it's a bit of a turn-off, actually. Being a tightwad is a bit of a turn-off, you know. And I've learnt this the hard way. If ever I buy my wife a present from the Selfridges sale, I never admit it was in the sale, right? Okay, right. That's absolute death, right? And so, by the way, I bet there are a load of people over 70 on Tinder who are boasting about how great their pension is.
Context.
But, you know, I'm fairly confident that you know, that would be a major pull, you know, if you're in the over 70s dating market. But there are a load of other priorities that young people have to get their shit together, you know, the now near impossible business of buying a house, perhaps, okay, before they have to worry about long-term saving. And given the path dependency of life, it's absolutely fallacious to believe that what an economist would think is rational is actually optimal or rational in the real world.
Yeah. So, I think we probably agree that economists are the worst people on the planet.
I think it's abominable. I mean, I'm not quite as extreme as my friend Nassim Taleb, who thinks that the discipline shouldn't exist. Okay.
But it's a fairly extreme position. But no.
What I do think about it, though, is that it's Tim Harford, you know, has made a defence that I only pick on economics when it goes, a fairly fair criticism, that I only criticise economics when it's wrong. Okay. My argument to Tim Harford there, I love the guy, by the way, and he's great. And he's also, again, one of the people who's open-minded enough to know both strengths and weaknesses of economics, is that what you've created in economics is a bit like Formula One, where the pit crew is more interesting than the car. You know, in other words, the car is so unreliable that actually the behavior of the pit crew is actually more important. What in other words, the problems are actually more important than the actual solutions. And I think you know, so behavioral economics, complexity economics, Austrian school economics, all the kind of Marxism, actually. There's quite a lot. I mean, having started off from a sort of standard conservative position that Marxism is bonkers, the guy is, like many other people, is not terrible at psychology, I think. And I think Marx didn't really understand a whole load of, you know, psychological factors at work. But nonetheless, there's some very interesting stuff there. If you want to understand what's gone wrong with the property market, okay, you might say that the investment value of property has come to dwarf its use value. And in that, you'd be using kind of Marxist language, okay? I'm also a Georgist, by the way. I won't go into this because it takes explanation and it's impossible to convert anybody to Georgism anyway, so I always feel it's a bloody lost cause. But I mean, the dissident economic schools actually have, in a way, more to teach us because they're much richer in counterintuitive anecdote, insight, surprise, and actually in business, in the creation of economic value, and actually in science. Noticing the anomaly is actually more important in many cases than cataloguing the regularities. And I worry about science in this way, that it's with things like p-values, it's how confidently can we generalize about something. Okay, now actually in business, you know, asking what's everybody else wrong about is probably the first question you should ask. What are the assumptions that are absolutely endemic in a category which actually either aren't true or maybe have been rendered no longer true by technology? Now, I always mention it, the Uber map, as a piece of psychological genius, which is, let's not worry so much about how quickly cars turn up. Let's instead use GPS plus the mobile smartphone to show people where their car is. And you can obtain the same or greater psychological end at a tiny fraction of the cost of changing the reality.
Yeah. Don't make the car quicker. Let people know where it is.
Let people know. And basically, okay, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, again, this is where I make the point. The rational argument isn't totally irrelevant. If Ubers took 45 minutes to turn up and it said driver smoking a fag, right? Okay. Then, you know, that's not a great car company. What I'm saying is that once you have punctuality within a certain acceptable threshold, further gains in speed of arrival actually may be a disadvantage, actually, because quite often I want to order an Uber when I'm on the 15th floor of a building and I still need to have a piss and go and hand back my pass. So I don't necessarily want cars that turn up in 4 minutes, actually.
Yeah, it needs to be a bit long.
Yeah.
So is the problem, because I think lots of things you talk about, we know that we have to, because of the way funding works, whether it's from businesses or government, things do have to generate a return. So what we've ended up looking for is the safest way to generate a return instead of the best way to generate a return.
You're absolutely right. The safest way. And secondly, the most provable way.
Yes.
Okay. So for example, it's always easier to quantify costs than it is to quantify opportunity costs. So that causes a disproportionate focus on cost cutting rather than opportunity hunting. Okay. And this, by the way, what's quite interesting is the advertising industry, with its obsession with digital performance marketing and measurement, actually exemplifies this problem in microcosm. Because effectively, people would rather spend money, quite a lot of performance marketing, I think, is getting people who would have bought the product anyway and are already customers of the retail site to buy something they would have bought anyway a bit sooner for a discount. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, that has a value. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that, you know, conversion of that kind or just overcoming inertia isn't a valuable role in marketing. But there's another more crucial role in marketing, which is getting people who didn't know about you and didn't think they wanted what you had to sell to buy what you have to buy at full price. Okay. Now, yep. The money from those two transactions might look quite similar, and it's much more expensive to obtain the second than the first, but the second is ultimately, measured over the long term, more valuable. And if you can't account for that incremental value, you will concentrate too much of your expenditure not on things that are necessarily valuable, but on things that are easy to prove aren't wasteful.
And it's a framing exercise again, isn't it? Because performance marketing looks, by its nature, over short-term attribution windows, 28 days, yeah. Whatever. I was at a conference the other week, and a guy from Ringside, a data platform, looked at data over from millions of transactions for the number of people who use it. And they found that people who make their first purchase at a discount are worth, over 3 years, are worth about 30% less than a person who makes their first purchase at full price.
That strikes me as highly plausible, yeah. Yeah, it's Yorkshireman again.
I know, listen. I've invested in that product as soon as I heard that. I was like, this is brilliant. So,
but no, that's exactly my point, which is that actually short-term transactional value doesn't necessarily reliably correlate with long-term customer lifetime value.
Yeah.
Also, there are a lot of things you can do in marketing which are valuable, which are impossible to quantify. Okay. I don't know why I always give this example. I have to think of a new one because it's probably getting a bit boring. But, you know, if you're the chief executive of Rolls-Royce Aero Engines, right, or the chief executive of Boeing, right, you can ring practically anybody on the planet in business or politics and they'll return you a call. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not true of, you know, the chief executive of, you know, to take those Amazon imaginary brands, you know, Wongwawu, so-and-so, whatever, okay? Right. Do you know why those are there? Those ludicrous sort of ludicrous brands on Amazon that look like Scrabble tiles.
Is that because we love brands as a...
No. It's actually weird. It's because Amazon gives great preference to brands that are registered in the US. Unfortunately, if you want to call yourself something cool, it takes much, much longer to register the brand and get approval from because of the problem of other people who have similar names. Whereas if you give yourself a totally ridiculous name, you can get registered overnight.
Right.
So it arises from the gaming of a system in a way.
There you go.
Which fascinated me because I couldn't understand. I thought, you know, because, you know, I mean, you know, someone in China, if you get, you know, gave me a tenner and a pint, I'd come up with a reasonable name for them. Okay. You know, but anyway, I think this is so interesting because what we're doing, don't get me wrong, but I cut my teeth and, you know, anybody in marketing who gets a chance to work for American Express do so. Because you learn everything in American Express. And I worked on American Express as a direct marketing copywriter. And it's got everything. It's a premium brand. It uses a lot of direct marketing. It's now got a lot of digital activity. It has member get member. It has a points program, a loyalty program. You know, there's nothing that you can learn about marketing that you can't learn working for American Express. It's a glorious brand, actually. I kind of idolize them a little bit. And actually, one thing, by the way, they answer the phone.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. Unique among financial services providers.
Amazing.
Okay.
Amazing.
They actually answer the goddamn phone. The interesting thing there was that, don't get me wrong, the conversion bit's important. Okay, because American Express built, back in the day, this fantastic prestige brand, which I think most prospective card members thought they couldn't afford. Or that they get turned down if they applied for it. Now, I think you needed to write to people to encourage them to apply, because the fact that you written to people in direct mail said, mm-hmm. You know, we know about you and you're the kind of person who carries this card. You know, I don't think the brand would have worked on its own without the direct marketing.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it would have been a very strong brand with not many card members. You know, in the same way that Versace is a very strong brand with not many customers, you know. And, you know, you need scale as a financial provider. And so I think, you know, the fact that you do both is really important. And, you know, and getting people over the last mile is sometimes the toughest challenge, after all, that, you know. And I'd also say that getting your conversion right is probably the first thing you should focus on, because there's not much point in optimizing things further up the funnel if the spout of the funnel is ridiculously narrow or clogged.
Mm-hmm. You have to eat while you dream, don't you?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And yet, what did worry me about the only problem in direct marketing is that the wonderful thing was you could measure the value of everything you did to the penny, albeit the short-term value. Okay.
Yep.
They did actually probably have a good idea of the. I never knew what it was, but the lifetime value of a card member. In fact, they probably had a reasonably good model for that. But okay, you're never allowed to do anything that you couldn't measure. And that's dangerous because, as I said, you know, what's it worth that the chief executive of Rolls-Royce can call anybody on the planet and get them to return his call? Well, it's patently worth millions in a sense, okay, in certain circumstances, right? But it'd be impossible to put an absolutely finite, clear dollar value on that. An awful lot of marketing is really not in pursuit of a predefined objective, although we like to think it is, it's actually opportunity maximization. All right?
Like
it's
that,
if I make myself famous, if you're a bit famous, well, I noticed this because I do quite a lot of public speaking. I pay all my public speaking fees to Ogilvy in an arrangement I made about 4 years ago where I made less money from public speaking. But broadly speaking, if you're quite famous, you will get invitations to speak from businesses you didn't even know existed at conferences you didn't even know took place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're quite famous as a business, you will get customers, employees, opportunities, partnerships brought to you that your own imagination would never have actually conjured up. Okay. But which other people's awareness of you then creates. Now, if you simply say the only role of marketing is that we define what success looks like in advance, very narrowly, and the only successful component of marketing is the extent to which it obtains and achieves objectives we have defined in advance, then you're massively undervaluing marketing. I'll give you a classic example of this, which is from my own experience, okay, which is, if you'd said to me, okay, we need to target readers for the book Alchemy, I would have said, well, people working in marketing, people interested in psychology, you know, there may be some people in the investment community who might be interested in this as a kind of, you know, distant way of looking at companies and company value or potential or whatever. But, you know, by and large, I would have defined core target audiences in one way or another. And then one day, a few years ago, I'm at Cannes, and Chris Evans decides to do his Virgin breakfast show on Virgin Radio from the Cannes Advertising Festival. And one of his underlings had read Alchemy and said, this guy's probably in Cannes because he works in advertising. Why don't you interview him about his book? So I turn up, do the interview on Chris Evans' breakfast show. Okay, 1 million listeners. And it goes quite well, and Chris has obviously skim read the book. I didn't expect him to read the whole damn thing because he'd only heard about the book a few hours beforehand. But then he spends the next day, the rest of the day, reading the book on the beach. I didn't know this, okay. And the following day on Chris Evans's breakfast show, he was quoting and citing little details from the book and mentioning the book quite frequently. Okay.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, unbeknownst, because obviously I'm not listening to Virgin Radio while I'm in France. Okay, unbeknownst to me, I'm sitting in a hotel room and I can't understand what's going on because the sales of my book on Amazon are just insane. Okay, I mean, I was outselling all of J.K. Rowling. Okay, I beat the Highway Code, which when you think about it is compulsory to buy. Okay, I never beat the Little Book of Nom, and I never beat the Hungry Little Fucking Caterpillar. Okay, and there are about six other, most of them cookery books, I think, and one footballer's biography, which I couldn't beat. But I was number 8 on Amazon of all books, right?
Incredible.
Now, not every single person, 94% of the people who bought that book on that day would have lain outside the... Now, what's the value of it? Well, actually, Maybe they like the book and they buy another copy for their friends. Okay, so that's another aspect of the sale, which is actually impossible to quantify. And so this business of quantification bias comes from physics. And it comes from physics because in Newtonian physics, okay, you have all the numbers you need to produce a single demonstrably correct prediction. Okay.
Yeah.
Moreover, the laws of physics don't change. The laws of psychology and behavior do. Okay. Fashion is one example of the laws of psychology changing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the really interesting thing there is that this urge for certainty looks like it's being scientific, but it's actually a massive constraint on discovery. Nice. I mean, okay, never mind business, okay? I think most business, really major business breakthroughs happen kind of creatively or accidentally or through someone noticing a freak thing that they can't explain, okay? Mm-hmm. Or through actual insanity in the case of Dyson. You know, I mean, I would have advised him against making an 800-pound vacuum cleaner. Okay.
Yeah.
Turns out there is a market for those things. Who knew, right? Now, actually, when we delve deep enough, that's also how most scientific progress happens. The idea that we should actually decide what is important to investigate in advance. Science is just as bad as government and business in actually predicting where you should explore. And therefore, in many ways, that when you're a bit random, yes, your chance of failure is probably higher. Your chance of success is lower, but your chance of absolutely transformational success might well make up for that problem.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that when weird succeeds, it really, really succeeds.
We're back to the realms of penicillin then, aren't we, in terms of things like...
Well, not just penicillin, but the Wolf's Vianetta.
Much more important.
Much more, of course, you know, I mean, there's Fleming getting all the credit. The Wolf's Vianetta happened because there was a wonky conveyor belt, and what should have been a slab of ice cream turned into scroll work.
Get out of town, seriously.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. And Christmas has never been the same since in the Jarvis household anyway.
Absolutely right, yeah.
So tell me, I've just spotted the time, Rory, and I'm really sorry. We've gone over the top of the hour, but can I ask you one more question I want to throw
at you? Of course.
If you are a marketer, a brand manager, head of marketing, that type of person, sat in your company listening to this going, damn it, I agree with everything Rory says. Absolutely. You go into work tomorrow morning and what do you do? Because you know that the board are probably too busy looking at the kind of rational McKinsey-ized projections of what success looks like. So what do you do if you're in that role?
I have one example, which is that one solution so far, I'm trying to come up with more, obviously, which is that you explain the statistical and other biases involved that essentially make companies too cautious. And you argue for the ring fencing of a small amount of what you might call psychological R&D money, okay? Which is, and this is actually mathematical, this is called the explore-exploit trade-off. It happens in algorithms, it happens in animal foraging, in all kinds of places. And you just go, whatever the ratio is between exploiting what we already know and exploring what we don't, it's patently obvious that we don't know everything, least of all about the future. And therefore, some, for the long-term profitability, survival, and growth of a company, some degree of exploration and experimentation is necessary in the marketing space, just as it is in the R&D space. Which brings me full circle to the point I made at the very beginning.
Absolutely.
But we haven't even talked about trains, so I'd like to do a follow-up session, if that's okay.
Hey, listen, I am... do you have to go? Because if you don't have to go...
I do. Unfortunately, I do.
That's okay. Well, listen... Trains are have a special place in my heart, so we will get you back another time, Rory, to talk about trains. I absolutely promise that. And flexible working and the Mad Fest as well. So
absolutely delighted. Nudstock, 7th of July, by the way, nudstock.com.
Nudstock.com. All the details are in the show notes. And if you can be there, do be there, because you're in for an absolute treat. Rory Sutherland, thank you very much for your
time. It's a pleasure.
Enjoy the rest of your day. It's been an absolute hoot. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.